This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Support for this public radio podcast comes from KeyBank Capital Markets, specializing in corporate and investment banking solutions for established and growing mid-sized companies. Visit key.com/KBCM. And by the Society for Human Resource Management, meeting the challenges of a changing world, online at shrm.org. Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, managing nearly $9 million in municipal bond assets. Details at putnam.com. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Oh, for the days when you could just unplug. Find yourself some dead zone with no email, no cell phone, where you could just be. Those spots are getting harder to find, of course, and today a high-tech consortium tried to make them go away forever. WiMAX is the latest buzzword you're going to need to know, folks. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Advanta. Advanta salutes small business, the brave ones, the risk takers, all those who chase a dream and make their own way. And by the Society for Human Resource Management, meeting the challenges of a changing world. Online at shrm.org.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Great to have you with us on this Wednesday. Today is the 7th of May, and just so we're clear here, it's WiMAX. W-I-M-A-X is how you spell it. It's the follow-on to Wi-Fi. Another way to put it would be $14.5 billion worth of internet. That's the price tag on the deal announced today by Sprint and a company called Clearwire. If all the digital ones and zeros line up right, WiMAX would make it possible for you to be online essentially all the time. The profit potential there is mind-boggling, right? Which is why a slew of high-tech and telecommunications companies have climbed on the bandwagon, too. Comcast, Time Warner, Intel, yeah, even Google. Marketplace's Lisa Napoli has the story.
If you love having wireless in your house, you're really going to love WiMAX. Just think, speedy net connections, no wires, with the range of a cell phone network.
We've all been sort of waiting for this. This is really the tipping point in our estimation.
Declan Byrne is with Airspan, a company that makes WiMAX equipment. He says people have been talking about the potential of this technology for a while. Verizon Wireless and AT&T have announced they're getting into the game. But this new joint venture among cable, telecom, and tech players called Clearwire could be up and running far sooner. Analyst Glenn Fleischman of Wi-Fi Networking News says WiMAX means all access all the time.
This is going to deliver something like the home broadband experience wherever you go. This is going to boost that to the next level, and it's also going to be competitive and supplementary in some markets where you can't get good cable and DSL service.
Now, providing wireless broadband to rural areas is one benefit of WiMAX, but the thing that's got everyone really excited is WiMAX's ability to let you do even more, even faster, with your cell phone, like downloading videos and movies. Tricia Duryea of MoCoNews.net says that's why Google has plunked down $500 million to be part of the Clearwire deal.
They're seeing WiMAX as a way to get all of their applications onto a wireless network.
Since to many companies, not just Google, the mobile phone is the immediate future of the internet. In Los Angeles, I'm Lisa Napoli for Marketplace.
From mobile to the more mundane now, worker productivity is one of those rare economic statistics that isn't so hard to wrap your brain around. Widgets produced per hour worked is the formula, and it sounds pretty straightforward. On the face of it, today's report that productivity in the first quarter rose at an annual rate of better than 2% was pretty good. A, it was higher than most economists expected. And B, we also learned wages were essentially flat when compared with inflation. But one of the first things you do learn with rosy economic statistics is that sometimes there's less to them than meets the eye, as Marketplace's Dan Gretsch explains.
Since 2000, workers have increased their productivity by nearly 20%. But during that same period, average hourly wages increased by only 3%.
The American workforce is working harder, smarter, and longer. Essentially, they're baking a bigger pie, but they're taking home smaller slices.
That's Jared Bernstein with the Economic Policy Institute. He says the gap between productivity growth and wages is at a historic high. The reason? More money is ending up in the pockets of the wealthy.
Inequality is a wedge that has gotten between the productivity growth that the typical worker contributes to the economy and their take-home pay.
But some economists say the problem is not with income inequality. It's with the government's numbers. The Heritage Foundation's James Shirk says when you factor in non-cash compensation, like health care benefits and time off, and adjust differently for inflation, compensation isn't that out of sync with productivity.
So there's a small difference, but not nearly this yawning chasm that so many people talk about.
One thing that's not in dispute, many Americans feel they're working harder just to tread water. I'm Dan Gretsch for Marketplace.
The housing crisis was back at center stage today on Capitol Hill. The House is debating its $300 billion rescue package, the one sponsored by Democrat Barney Frank. Frank is the chairman of the House Financial Services Committee, and his bill would dramatically increase the role of an agency called the Federal Housing Administration as a way to clean up the subprime mess. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall Genzer takes a look now at whether the FHA is up to the job.
The FHA was created at the height of the Depression. It doesn't lend money. It insures mortgages. But it's avoided the subprime crowd. It usually works with borrowers who've saved up a deposit and prove they can make monthly payments. The House bill sponsored by Massachusetts Democrat Barney Frank requires the FHA to take on much riskier loans.
But we do have serious concerns about Barney Frank's bill.
Meg Burns helps oversee FHA's home mortgage insurance program. She says the bill sticks the FHA with bad loans taken out by overstretched borrowers who are beyond help.
There are some families who simply are out of reach, even for the FHA.
Burns says those families will default on their loans. Under Frank's bill, the FHA would be left holding the bag. Tottering under that load, it would need more money from taxpayers, more than $2 billion, according to the Congressional Budget Office. But Princeton economist Alan Blinder says that's just a fraction of what the savings and loan bailout cost two decades ago. He says the FHA is up to the task.
The FHA is going to have to staff up substantially and change in character somewhat. But that seems to me a small price to pay.
But Guy Sakala of Inside Mortgage Finance says the best solution may be beyond the FHA or Congress.
The real solution is time, and nobody wants to wait a year or two and see all the people put out of their homes. But to some extent, that's the only sure thing at this point.
In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall Genzer for Marketplace.
This might be an opportune moment to mention oil prices. Crude topped off at a record $123.90 today, closed just a tad lower. Never mind that report this morning that oil reserves were actually higher last week. Gas, as you know, isn't getting any cheaper either. The experts say careful driving can stretch your mileage, not gunning the engine, keeping an eye on your speed, those kinds of things. Ford said today it wants to help consumers get more from a tank of gas and at the same time bump its own fuel economy performance. The company announced today it's going to start installing a new kind of transmission in nearly all of its vehicles. From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, Sam Eaton reports.
Ford says it can boost fuel economy up to 6% by replacing its standard 4-speed automatic transmission with a new 6-speed model. Tom Libby with J.D. Power says the reason is simple.
It's just like a bicycle. You know, the fewer times you pedal around, the less energy is being used.
A lot less energy when you consider Ford plans to put the new transmissions in 98% of its North American cars and trucks by 2012. Libby says Congress's new requirement to reach a fleet-wide average of 35 miles per gallon by 2020 may be the spark for that change. But the motivation is doing it on the cheap.
They're looking at every product plan, every model, and every powertrain in every model, and figuring out what mix they have to have in every one of those to hit an average of 35 miles per gallon. And then for all of those choices they make, they're looking at the most inexpensive way to do it.
That has many environmentalists rolling their eyes. The auto industry's main argument against higher fuel economy standards was that meeting them would be too costly and would harm the already struggling U.S. auto industry. Roland Wong with the Natural Resources Defense Council says Ford's actions prove they've been crying wolf.
They know how to do this. But of course, a lot of these technologies have been used for higher performance, higher acceleration, and making the vehicle fleet bigger.
Wang says with the era of the gas-guzzling SUV coming to an end, automakers can now apply these technologies to lighter and smaller cars, adding up to more savings at the pump. I'm Sam Eaton for Marketplace.
Traders were on a downward spiral all day today, even as oil prices spiraled upward. We will have the details when we do the numbers. I don't know what all this talk is about a slowing economy, because we are spending money like it's burning a hole in our pockets, or a hole in our credit cards more properly. The Federal Reserve reported this morning consumer credit, that's basically everything we all owe money on except our houses, rose more than 7% last month to $2.5 trillion worth of revolving debt. Commentator Robert Reich says the mortgage crisis offers a valuable lesson in the hazards of our mounting credit card balances.
Americans owe billions on their credit cards, and the price tag is mounting daily as interest charges accumulate, even though most Americans are pulling in their belts and economizing. You see, for years, credit card companies have been sending us greater and greater sounding offers, but they've been hiding how much interest they'll be charging and how they calculate the outstanding balance. They suddenly increase annual interest rates, impose high penalty fees, even shorten billing cycles to make it harder to pay on time. Now, sure, they disclose their right to do this stuff when you sign up, but it's in print so small as to give you a headache even if you understand it. In other words, credit card companies offer what look like great deals, but become nightmares for millions of Americans. Sound familiar? It's just like what mortgage lenders were doing before the bust. But the housing bust has been something of a wake-up call, and now both Congress and the Fed are considering banning these practices. Yet the American Bankers Association is vowing to block these reforms. It argues that stopping credit card companies from bilking their customers who get behind on their payments will increase the costs of credit to those of us who pay on time. Sound familiar? It's much the same argument mortgage lenders are using for why their abusive lending practices should be allowed to continue. Make no mistake, the Bankers Association is a powerful lobby. And it's not just Republicans they control. Only 11 of 36 Democrats on the House Financial Services Committee have backed the bill so far, and the going is likely to be rougher in the Senate, which is why the Fed may be the only hope for protecting Americans while avoiding the kind of meltdown that hit the mortgage market. It's another reminder of how our democracy has drifted into the hands of non-democratic agencies like the Fed, because the political branches are answerable to money interests rather than to the public interest.
Robert Reich teaches public policy at the University of California, Berkeley. His latest book is called Supercapitalism. Send us your thoughts. Won't cost you a dime on your credit card. Our website is marketplace.org. Click on the link that says contact. The president's had Cuba on his mind this week. Yesterday, President Bush held the first ever video conference with some high-profile Cuban dissidents down in Havana. In a speech today to the Council of the Americas, he said there has been, quoting here, no change at all since Raul Castro took over from his brother in February. The president also said he's not persuaded by recent pictures showing Cubans buying cell phones and laptops.
Cuba will not become a place of prosperity just by easing restrictions on the sale of products that the average Cuban cannot afford.
David Adams has been covering Cuba for the past 20 years. He is just back from his most recent visit. And Mr. Adams, what is your take on these moves by the government to allow the use of previously forbidden technology there?
They do show an inclination to change things that haven't been working in Cuba, and many analysts feel that that's a good step in the right direction. But as people often say in Cuba, you know, I can't eat a cell phone. And the thing that is uppermost in most Cuban minds right now is, how am I going to improve my diet and how am I going to improve my living conditions on the meager salary that I make? And, you know, most Cubans only make more or less between $10 or $15 a month.
Assuming Raul Castro wants to keep the revolution alive, and I suppose we all do have to assume that, how's he going to do it when people see these luxuries but can't get at them making $10 a month?
Well, I think that's the key. I mean, Raul Castro is looking long term, and he knows that if the revolution is going to survive, then it does have to find a way to improve the quality of life of Cubans. And that right now really rests upon improving its food production. Cuba pays a huge amount of money to import food. And so the most important reforms, which we haven't mentioned, and they really are the most important reforms, is a decentralization of the agricultural production system in Cuba, allowing independent private farmers to have greater autonomy over the land that they produce on. This means actually giving out idle state land and giving them incentives to produce more and allowing them greater say in where they sell and at what price they sell. And Raul Castro is hoping that that's going to put a lot more food in the marketplaces in Cuba and hopefully bring up the value of the Cuban pesos, the state salaries that Cubans make, and give them a little bit more purchasing power. But that's going to, obviously, it's going to take a while. It's going to take several harvests.
What's the word in Spanish for reform?
Bueno, reforma, cambio, is change. The government doesn't seem to like the word reform. They prefer the word change or lifting of restrictions.
What's your sense out on the streets of this cambio? Are people expecting it, or are they just shrugging and saying, oh, it's more of the same?
Some people, they tend to be older. People often who have a little bit of access to foreign currency and so that their living conditions are a little bit better than those who live on the Cuban peso. And they tend to be slightly more optimistic. Then, you know, you talk to other people, particularly those people who are living on the Cuban peso and have no access to remittances from family abroad, for example, and for whom life is extremely difficult. They have to scratch together every meal. And they're not optimistic, I have to say. Someone I've known for some years told me, you know, to be honest, we're actually worse off today than we were in July 2006 when Fidel got sick. We really have no hope for change. We know this system is the system that they intend to keep us living under as long as they possibly can.
David Adams is the Latin American Bureau Chief for the St. Petersburg Times down in Florida. Mr. Adams, thanks so much.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
Coming up, finding food to feed a billion.
Food has a kind of almost mythic importance in Chinese traditional culture.
But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials tumbled 1.5% today, 206 points to close at 12,814. The NASDAQ lopped off 1.8%, 44 points to close at 2438. The S&P 500 cranked down 1.6%. That was 22 points, ended the day at 1395. Cisco Systems posted healthy earnings after the bell yesterday, but investors were unimpressed. Its shares dropped 2% today. The Walt Disney Company was one of the happiest stocks on the exchange today, coasting up almost 3% on the strength of its brisk theme park businesses. Both U.S. Airways and UAL Corp. took some turbulence on news that a potential merger of those two carriers will be tough to get off the ground. U.S. Airways stock took an 8.5% nosedive today. UAL propelled 2.33% lower. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, where a 529 plan can help meet your college savings goals. Details at Putnam.com. And by Clarks and Potters, The Splendid Table's How to Eat Supper, the cookbook inspired by the radio program for people who love to eat. Available now. Every day's marketplace is put together the day of. If you want to get the show info as it's being created, sign up for the Marketplace Midday Update. It also includes upcoming special projects on the show. Go to marketplace.org and click on the newsletter link.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at what's coming up Thursday. In Washington, the Senate Environment and Public Works Committee discusses the transportation of goods on the nation's highways. The House Transportation and Infrastructure Committee holds a joint hearing with the Budget Committee on how to invest in our nation's roads, bridges, and waterways. And Russian Parliament is expected to vote on whether to confirm Vladimir Putin as Prime Minister. His presidential successor was sworn in today. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal.
In Haiti, deadly riots over food prices.
Costco is now limiting purchases of rice and
soy. Winter wheat in Kansas City's up 25 cents. Corn prices.
Those wheat prices doubled since last fall. Corn's tripled in the past couple of years. Premium grade rice has hit $1,000 a ton. I could reel off a whole list here, but you get my drift. So for the rest of the week on the program, Food Fight, a special series about the global food crisis. Agricultural economists have been saying for years that this was going to happen. But for most of the rest of us, the worldwide spike in food commodity prices has come pretty much out of the blue.
You know, in our research, it really comes down to the globalization of the world economy.
Dan Bossi is an economist with Ag Resource. That's a consulting firm out in Chicago. For him, globalization's a fancy way of saying supply and demand. Globalization, the theory goes, brings rising standards of living to developing countries. That brings more money, and that brings the demand.
When these people all make more money, they spend a lot of it on diet.
Diets like ours, Bossi says.
If everybody ate like an American, as I go around the world, that seems to be their goal. We need about another 2.3 globes.
The ag economists working in developing countries saw today's shortages coming long ago. They laid in reserves, food stockpiles, just not enough of them.
For 5 years, it was those extra government stocks that the Indians and the Chinese and a lot of governments, including the Philippines and Southeast Asia, had really satisfied their demand. But at some point, the cupboard ran dry, and that seems to be about 12 months ago. And it was that tipping point, if you will, that really turned everyone towards looking at rising food prices. Speculators poured into the marketplace, and it kind of got us to where we are here today.
Throwing the rising cost of oil and the unanticipated consequences of turning food into biofuel, you get a world caught unaware, and you get deadly food riots like we've seen this week in Somalia. Bossi says, though, that as grim as the situation appears right now, the law of supply and demand does offer some cause for optimism.
There's an old saying that goes, there's no cure for high prices like high prices.
Higher prices drive better profits, which will in turn drive farmers to plant more of those profitable crops. But the fix, like everything in agriculture, won't be quick. Bossi says it's going to be 6 or 7 years before prices even get close to where they used to be. Some of the variables that have been sending world food prices higher are reversible. Bad harvests, bad weather, biofuel policy, they could all conceivably turn around. But over the long term, there is one big unknown we can't really control. The growing collective appetite of 1.3 billion people. From Shanghai, Marketplace's Scott Tong reports.
30-something Jane Hua strolls through a Shanghai supermarket. Not too long ago, food was rationed here.
When I was a child, I recall we will have a coupon to buy rice or milk, something like that.
Oh, what a difference a couple decades makes. Today, Jane wheels her cart around imported avocados, sushi, Oreos, and all types of meat. She buys them all.
For a soup, something, well, I'll just choose chicken. If I just want to have a party, for example, and then just probably I will use beef.
Which goes for $5 a pound. Jane is the face of China's new middle class. By some estimates, 100 million people and counting. China, and India too, is developing an appetite for a wide range of foods, long out of reach for most citizens. These slow-motion dietary changes may be on the cusp of impacting world food markets. Take pork, by far China's main meat. Back in 1983, the average Chinese person ate 2 pounds a month. Now it's 7 pounds. And to raise one hog, say it weighs 200 pounds, it takes 800 pounds of feed, like soybeans. And China's appetite for meat is not going to stop anytime soon. Consider this. In the next 15 years, 200 million Chinese will migrate from the countryside to the cities in search of better pay and better food. And that means protein.
And all of the numbers that you deal with in operating in China are just astronomical.
William McCahill is with a consulting firm, J.L. McGregor.
And of course, when they get graft against global supplies of foodstuffs, as against global supplies of other commodities that China has begun importing. These have a great impact on the global balance of supply and demand.
Many analysts say hungry China will help keep world food prices high for the next decade. Part of the problem is China was dealt a horrible hand by Mother Nature. With 1.3 billion people, China has 22% of the world's population, but just 8% of its arable land, which is shrinking. Outside Shanghai, families grow soybeans and corn on little plots. That is, plots that urban sprawl hasn't invaded, says farmer Chen Jianguo.
In the last 2-3 years, things have really changed. There are more factories here than before. And all the roads out here, they're new.
So far, China has largely managed to feed itself. But David Orden of the International Food Policy Research Institute thinks that no longer makes economic sense.
Increasingly, China should use the international markets. It's a country with a small land base for its population size. As income grows, China should be importing food, exporting other products to pay for it.
But food security is a touchy subject here. When the communists took power in 1949, they promised food self-sufficiency, says consultant McCahill.
Remember Mao, on the day he declared the People's Republic, stood in Tiananmen and said, "Today the Chinese people have stood up." And part of that had to do with independence from foreign supplies of food. Food has a kind of almost mythic importance in Chinese traditional culture.
Publicly, Beijing says China can keep supplying itself. It's passed rules to preserve precious farmland and squeeze more out of it. Liu Guoxiang is with the Chinese Academy for Social Sciences.
The Chinese government has paid special attention to farming and food security, so the trend of self-reliance won't change since it's such a high priority.
Perhaps, but skeptics think it's just a matter of time before China imports vast amounts of grain to feed its ever wealthier, ever chubbier population, and suppliers and grocery shoppers everywhere will feel it. In Shanghai, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Our series, Food Fight, continues tomorrow. We'll take a look at how agribusiness is making cleaning your plate pricier. For more of our coverage of the global food crisis, our website is the place to go. It's marketplace.org.
Marketplace is supported by America's Family Physicians, offering patient-centered care so employees can better manage their health and employers better manage their costs. AAFP.org. And by Putnam Investments, managing a wide range of tax-exempt portfolios. Details at Putnam.com. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
This final note today, never mind that the Yahoo deal's not even cold yet, but there is word Microsoft CEO Steve Ballmer's looking around for another acquisition. It's a company Microsoft already owns a chunk of, Facebook. The Wall Street Journal is reporting today Microsoft is poking around to see about buying up the rest of it. Last year, you might remember, Ballmer paid $240 million for about 1.5% of the social networking site. At that price, the whole thing would go for something like $15 billion today. Kind of makes you wonder what Yahoo CEO Jerry Yang's thinking about right now, doesn't it? That is Marketplace for today from American Public Media. Today, the Dow lost 206 points. That's 1.5%. The NASDAQ dropped 44 points, 1.8%. The S&P 500 lost 22 points. That's 1.6% there. Ravi Karman, Chris Clark, Stephen Colon, Eric Johnson, Jeff Peters, Aaron Scott, and Phil Stearns engineered the program for us. Coming up tomorrow on our series, Food Fight, concern over growing profits in agriculture.
A real risk is for them to be equated like the big oil companies. Consumers were complaining about paying so much at the fuel pump. Meanwhile, these oil companies are generating record profits.
I'm Kai Rizdal. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.